Everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. I'm Alex Hochuli in São Paulo, Brazil, and today we're talking about Portugal. So I'd like to welcome back, very happy to welcome back, Catarina Príncipe, who's a longtime activist on the Portuguese left. She's currently doing her PhD in political economy. And when we last saw each other, in fact, in person, very long ago, 2019, where we did a live event in London, a BungaCast event on European politics. So firstly, welcome back, Catarina. But secondly, and actually far more importantly, happy birthday. Very generous of you to spend your time
you.
With me virtually here talking about Portuguese politics on your birthday.
Thank you. And nice to see you again, Alex.
Yeah, no, likewise. This is good. So Portugal has just held an election this past weekend on the 10th of March. Before we get into the ins and outs, the results, who's voting for what, the rise of a right populist party, which is breaking Portugal's duopoly, all the rest of that stuff, and also maybe some historical reflections, because we're coming up to 50 years since the Carnation Revolution in Portugal. That'll be celebrated next month. So before we get to all that, for people who don't really know Portugal, and especially, I think, you know, outside of Europe, or even for, you know, inside of Europe, it's seen as maybe, well, it's a holiday destination for many Europeans. Tourism has massively boomed in Portugal. Otherwise, you know, kind of a quiet, small Mediterranean country that exports olive oil, had this big history of colonization and conquest. But that was very, very long ago. And since then, you know, what's Portugal been up to? So that's the view from outside, not from Brazil, I should say, because Brazilians will have a different and probably more detailed view of what Portugal is. But I wanted to flip the question around, actually, and ask you how Portugal sees itself. How does it see itself within the European context, and maybe historically at this point in history?
Yeah, that is indeed a really bit of a tough question.
Yeah, this is one of these really annoying questions.
Yes. So maybe starting where you started, I think Portugal sees itself as a small country in the European periphery. There's a kind of an interesting dynamic that people say in Portugal, like people use a lot the sentence of they're in Europe. So, you know, they're in Europe, things are happening as if we were not part. So on the one hand, joining the European community was the direct outcome of the Portuguese Revolution 50 years ago. So it was a process that started immediately the year after. And so the whole political map and the whole political debate turned into Europe. At the same time, it's a country that never felt that it fully belonged. You know, we are the periphery of the periphery in Europe, right? And Portugal did become a bit more well-known internationally, I guess, during the Troika years, during the austerity years, because it was, compared to Greece, sort of the good student of Europe, like the good student of Merkel. Whilst in Greece, you had an anti-austerity government elected with all its shortcuts and contradictions that we have explored also before, and you have as well. Portugal, on the contrary, although it had like big waves of mobilization, maintained a right-wing government for 4 years that in ways went even too farer than the Troika implications. So Portugal, I think, became well-known as this like sort of quiet, good student, austerity abiding member of the European Union. So that is also just one part of the story, because I think Portuguese people don't actually see themselves like this. I think in general, Portuguese people are very proud of their democratic history. The fact that we actually had the last socialist revolution in the Western world is still something that is very important to, I would say, to a an older generation very much so that took part of it. But even my generation, like we grew up with this idea and with this sort of left-wing in heritage, even if it became less ideological, because during the revolution, you know, there were the creation of 38 parties and there was a lot of ideological debate. The questions of equality, the existence of a national health system, of a public education system, of still quite decent labor laws compared to other countries, even in Europe, is something that Portuguese people are proud of. So I think it is a very contradictory self-view. On the one hand, we're just small and powerless, and, you know, we are in Europe, but not really. We are part of the club of the rich, which is the European Union, but we actually are not rich. But at the same time, there is some pride on this collective left-wing inheritance. And that makes it for a very sad moment that the year that we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of this revolution that shaped the Portuguese state as it is, and also a lot of Portuguese self-identity, that we actually just elected 48 populist far-right MPs to the Portuguese parliament. So that is still, you know, it shows also the, it sort of makes it palpable, the contradictory position, I would say.
Right. So, I mean, I guess getting on to the election, just in the lead up to it, you've had a government led by the Socialist Party. Actually, since the last election, they managed a very small majority. Is that right? And so since 2022, they've been kind of governing mostly on their own. What's that government been like since, maybe not just since 2022, but in the whole period since they deposed the center-right party?
Yeah, I think to understand what happened in 2022, we need to just go a little bit back. And I don't want to make this like in detail, but in 2015, in October 2015, the center-right government that applied, actually the Troika memorandum, was deposed. But although they won in terms of voting and MPs, the way in which, because Portugal has a parliamentary system, the way in which the parliament itself was composed meant that the left, meaning the Socialist Party, which is the center-left party, the left bloc and the Communist Party actually had more MPs on parliament. And so for the first time in Portuguese history, these three parties made an agreement, a governmental agreement. So the left did not enter the government. It gave its parliamentary support, which in fact means that the left agrees to, after negotiation procedures, vote in favor for the yearly state budget. That's, you know, in practice what it means. And that happened steadily from 2015 to 2019. And then we had elections again, normal electoral cycle. And that's where things started to go a bit wobbly, because both the left bloc and the Communist Party started to understand that this form of parliamentary support wasn't actually giving them a lot of gains. On the one hand, they were not strong enough to actually impose a lot of the political decisions of the socialist government, the Socialist Party government. But on the other hand, they were seen as co-responsible for the government, right? So there was the party started to have a shift, the leadership of the parties, because that had been a discussion that I myself was very involved with at the time as well. But the party leadership on both parties started to understand that they couldn't really continue to sort of play this game. So after 2019, the left started to drop a little bit. And so 1 year later, Bloco withdrew the parliamentary support for the Socialist Party government. The CP still supported it one more year, but then in 2022, they withdrew the support, and that's why the government fell. So we had snap elections in 2022. And these snap elections are very interesting, I think, to understand what is happening now, because against all odds, the Socialist Party had an absolute majority on parliament. They didn't have a tiny majority. They had an absolute majority. And that both showed for that in terms of the left, it showed that the left was caught in a very complicated situation, because on the one hand, they were punished. Some people punished the left for having supported a government that didn't deliver. Mm-hmm. And some people punished the left for not supporting them anymore. Right?
Right.
So the left was caught in this conundrum. And so that's when both bloc, when the Communist Party had a huge drop, both in the total amount of votes as in parliamentary representation. That pulled the vote from the left into the Socialist Party, but something else also happened. And this is very important to understand what happened on Sunday, was that the leader of the Social Democratic Party, which is our center-right party, the PSD, you know, I always say this, but I think it's always good to remember that Portuguese politics parties have very left-wing names because they were all formed during the revolution, right? So that's why. So our center-right party, at the time, the leader they had at the time did not exclude the possibility of making a government with the far-right populist party that was already growing on the polls. He did not exclude that option. So the Socialist Party got a lot of sort of this utility vote, both from the left as a way of sort of punishment, but also from the right, from people who did not want the Social Democratic Party to win because they would make an agreement with Chega. And so that's why I think the Socialist Party had a very strong, because it was an absolute majority, but at the same time, a very weak politically majority, because it wasn't based on neither a new leader nor new politics. It was not an inflamed campaign. It was utility vote both on the left and on the right.
Right. So, I mean, to move back to, well, to this past weekend, you have a situation where the traditional duopoly of the center-left led by the Socialist Party and the center-right led by the Social Democratic Party is broken by Chega, which for listeners, it means enough. Exclamation mark, enough. I don't know if that has any, I'm curious actually whether that has any kind of particular resonance in Portugal in reference to some old slogans. I don't know, or if it's just some new idea. I mean, very generic, right?
Yeah, it's just this sort of like... I actually do think the name has is a very good representation of far right populism. You know, it's a very empty neoliberal program that's swift sides all the time. So it's just enough, you know. So it's sort of like taking up the anti system, the discontent feeling of people. So I think the name is perfect for that.
Yeah, anti politics kind of. Yes. Well, that's interesting. I mean, just as an aside, I find it interesting because, as you mentioned, that all Portuguese parties tend to have left wing names because of the inheritance of the revolution. Funnily enough, you know, Brazil has a similar process as well, from re-democratization, all these names which sound kind of democratic, progressive, whatever, and they're like the worst right wing kind of corrupt old parties. But it's interesting that, you know, thinking about 50 years since the Carnation Revolution, that you have this party which actually doesn't have any kind of obvious left-wing resonances in its name coming up. It's just called Chega. I will delve more into that in a second. But just give us a view of what the results were. It seems that there was a lot of interest in this election. The turnout was higher than it's been in 3 decades, but at the same time, it was only 66%, which isn't that high either. So maybe paint us a picture of what's actually happened.
Yeah, actually, turnout in Portugal has been quite low for many decades, and you can see it, like, it's actually an interesting... I just lost my earring, and it will be part of this podcast. actually, there is an interesting phenomena of turnout in Portugal, because if you look at the turnout results, they drop each time there is an accentuation of European integration. It's actually interesting, to see that. Portuguese, the turnout in elections is quite low. for European standards, definitely quite low. But it was the lowest since 95. And that played a very big and, I think, interesting role in electing the number of MPs that Shiga did. So what they were actually capable of doing was bringing out people to vote. So what I think is more important in this election, besides, you know, the voting patterns, where did the vote come from, you know, the shifting patterns, that is also something we can talk about, because there are some interesting innuendos in that. But what I think is really phenomenal about what happened was that Shiga actually got people to vote again in ways that the left had not been able to do for a long time. And so that says something. And I do think that it says, one, it does reveal a degree of discontent as we haven't seen in a long time. But it also reveals, secondly, and this is important for the left, it also revealed that the left is not seen as the discontent vote. So the anti-system party, the parties that can change. And that is also, of course, because they were part of the government that led to the situation, right? So if you don't vote as a discontent on the left, Shiga sort of encapsulated these two dynamics. So you have, they brought out people who have not voted for a long time, and they brought out a lot of young voters. There's a lot of young people voting for them. This is also not a new phenomenon in terms of populist far-right parties, but it is new for us. It shows, right? So they are now the third party, and there has never been in Portugal, I believe, a third party with as much power as they have. They had 18% of the votes, so more than 1 million votes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's very interesting. One thing I noted in reading the news about it is that the president, who holds a kind of symbolic constitutional role, right? He said that Rebelo de Sousa, right, mm-hmm. Says he would do whatever he could to stop Shiga gaining power, which would seem to just fortify Shiga's anti-establishment, anti-system sort of vote. How did that play out?
Yeah, that was so. He actually, we have a parliamentary system and semi-presidential. So we do have a president of the republic. Who is, besides, you know, the sort of the diplomatic figure, but, you know, the leader of the armed forces, he also has the capacity to dissolve a parliament. And he's the one who, I don't know actually this expression in English, but like he's the one who gives, you know, who says like, okay, you should try to form a party, then you should try to form a party. So he has sort of mediation, but also he has the atomic bomb on his hand. He can dissolve the party. So it hasn't happened many times, but it has happened. The president in Portugal, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, he's a very present figure in Portuguese politics. He's a longtime member of the Social Democratic Party. He was a journalist, a political commentator on TV for many years, and so he's very present on the Portuguese day-to-day political cycles. But he actually managed to kind of stay away during the elections, which is sort of news for him because he normally tends to talk every day. But then on Friday, I believe it was on Friday, so just before the elections, he said that he would do anything to keep Shiga out of government. And that, of course, first, that is a role that constitutionally the president cannot play. And secondly, of course, it inflames the anti-system, like this idea that the system is rigged against the ones who are telling the truth, against corruption, you know, all of this narrative, it also inflamed it. So it was, I believe, actually also a help for Shiga to have the result that they did. I'm not saying that is the reason, but it definitely also contributed to that.
So we're going to delve a little bit more deeply into what Shiga is, because that's the new story, basically, in Portugal. It's kind of an already well-established story if you look at it kind of in a European or Western-wide scope, the kind of new right populist party gaining a lot of anti-system votes, having all the kind of rebellious energy to it and so on. But I want to know what's specific in the Portuguese context about it. Just before that, though, I want to know what was the pitch that the center-left alliance and the center-right alliance made to voters, particularly such that it would lead many to end up voting for Chega.
You mean the pitch? You mean like the electoral pitch?
Yeah, like in a sentence, like we're responsible and we're going to keep governing, or we're going to make your life better, or we're going to make your life worse, or whatever.
I mean, the left was not running in any form of coalition. So the CP was running by itself, Bloco was running by itself, and the Socialist Party by itself. So they, of course, had different pitches, right? I mean, Bloco and the CP were very, the whole campaign was very focused on the social state, the national health system that is collapsing, and also very much so the housing crisis, because that's a big thing that I believe we'll touch upon a little bit. But the main pitch was the most stable government of the last years was the government of the left. So you should vote for the CP or Bloco because we will support a government of the Socialist Party and create a stable government. The pitch of the Socialist Party was, we are the responsible ones. And we are the ones, you know, our mandate was interrupted due to some corruption scandal that is very strange. So the prime minister is under investigation, and that's why he resigned in November. But it doesn't seem that there are actually many substantial proof to that. So that will be also a question. So their pitch was, we're the responsible ones. We're the ones who want to save the social state. We're the ones who want to continue what we were doing. And now we're getting all this European funds. So we, you know, you need to vote for us because we're the, you know, continuation of a process where Portugal has been growing and stabilizing after austerity. And of course, the center right pitch was, they led us to this mess. So you need to vote for us if you want actual stability. So that is kind of the public debate was played out.
All in some ways, kind of a small C conservative pitch from both from the left itself, but also yes. From the center left and the center right. So I guess in that context, it's not terribly surprising that an upstart party saying we're against this has some success.
Firstly,
to kind of place it in context, and for those who follow European politics, we'll know there's lots of all these different varieties of the same thing, of this kind of right populist upstart anti-system energy. But there are some important differences. So I want to know whether it is of the more sort of nationalist or corporatist kind who defends, at least rhetorically, things like the welfare state or local jobs against foreign competition, which is more the sort of Marine Le Pen in France or Donald Trump in the U.S., kind of model, or if it's more of a standard neoliberal, economic policies with perhaps hard right policies on immigration and culture, which would be maybe more like Viktor Orban or Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. That kind of, you know, what type is it if you can place it in either of those two boxes?
On their own words, they are tendentially neoliberal and tendentially conservative.
So clearly they
are, I would say they are the Orban Wilders type. There is no actual corporatist thinking from the party. The first program of the party in 2022, now they had to refrain it a little bit because they were under very serious attack, was to privatize everything. Everything. So basically the plan was we end what is left of the social state. No more public health, no more public education, no more public social security, nothing. We privatize everything. And what you can see is there is a fraction of the Portuguese bourgeoisie that is behind them, of course. And that fraction is not the local, I mean, I'm not saying that there are no local medium-sized company people who are behind them, sure, but you have a fraction of it that is an internationalized bourgeoisie. So clearly that is not, that is not a sort of protectionist, nationalist form of political economy. Mm. It is a very neoliberal, very open, open to foreign investment, open to foreign markets sort of economic policy from the party. And then extremely conservative on the other questions. So on abortion, on one of their big banners is chemical castration for pedophilia, you know, things like that. So the sort of cultural shock, the cultural clash with the more liberal ideas. And of course, a very strong discourse on immigration, which in Portugal is complicated because we don't have, Portugal's not Spain. You see, we don't have masses of migrants, or Italy, we don't have masses of migrants coming. And actually the last study that was made by one of the, you know, the central statistic agency of the Portuguese government said that the migrants contributed like very positively to social security. Actually, without the migrants, the social security would have been in negative numbers. Mm. So, you know, it's like, it's, there is no actual reality. It's building on a fear that is brought from somewhere else, but that builds on insecurity. That is, you know, but so that is their pitch. So I would say in between your two categories, they fall more on the Orban style far right.
Right.
Although so although they have a lot of connections with Le Pen and Salvini and Abascal from Vox, for example, was in Portugal for the campaign. He was participating in Chega's campaign. So that is who they want to have their international relations with, of course.
Well, they, I saw Bolsonaro gave his support as well.
Yes, that is true. Yes, correct. Yeah.
We're going to get into immigration more in a second as well, because there's lots of Brazilians in Portugal who are probably the largest single group of migrants. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. But I wanted, before that, where did Chega get its votes from? Are they people who previously didn't vote? Mm-hmm. Are they former center-right voters who have radicalized rightwards, which is something that we've seen in lots of different places? Or are they lapsed left-wing, formerly like kind of socialist voting industrial workers who now vote for the right? What is the makeup of their vote? Because it's a new, a relatively new party. This is only, what, the second election that they fight, second national election?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know in all detail yet, because we're still waiting for, you know,
sure,
the actual people who are going to do the more fine-tuned analysis of this. But one, I would say they got a lot of votes from people who did not vote, what I was telling you before, and that is what partially explains, I would say actually it does explain why the turnout was higher this time than in other, the last 30 years. Another block of people that they got their votes from is people who are, you know, fed up with the system in general. So from there, you had a transition of votes from the Socialist Party to Chega. You had a transition of votes from the center right to Chega, because they also don't see it as an alternative. And you did have, which is the most preoccupying, I believe, one, you have a very big transition of votes from the Communist Party to Chega, particularly in the areas where the Communist Party used to even win, in Alentejo, which is the south of Portugal. This shows, I believe, a problem of the strategy of the Communist Party, because Alentejo used to be the place of the agrarian reform, of the big organization of waged farm workers. That doesn't exist anymore. A lot of the waged farm workers are being substituted by migrants, and it's a poor region where social services are scarce. And so Chega was able to build there and actually steal away the votes from the traditional, like, stronghold of the Communist Party. That is a very, I think, one of the most preoccupying dynamics, because it both means that the Communist Party is losing its representation, but also because it was the left wasn't able throughout these decades to actually read the transformation of the southern proletariat of the Portuguese state. So and Che Guevara was able to capture those people. So this is, I would say, the three big things. So it's a very loose vote, but as I told you before, and I think this is very important, I really believe, and maybe I will be proven wrong, but I really do believe that a lot of people also voted for them as a protest because they were sure that they would not get into government, because the leader of the Social Democratic Party, or the coalition AD, Aliança Democrática, Democratic Alliance, they repeated during the whole campaign, no is no. We will not make any form of governmental agreement with them. Which, and that didn't happen 2 years ago with the other leader, right? So I do think that a lot of this vote is a vote of protest that doesn't actually want it to be consequential. Mm-hmm. You know, I might be proven wrong about this, but I think this is why it's so important also right now to keep Luís Montenegro, who is the leader of the center-right coalition, keep him to his word. Because I truly believe that a lot of people voted for Chega thinking that they would not get into power, right?
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, I'd be interested to see what happens if they, do whatever right. they can to keep Chega out, and Chega is able to continue growing by being a repository for a lot of discontent with
the dilemma that they are facing. Because if they keep them out, they'll continue to be the opposition. Right? They'll continue to be the ones who can criticize the system without ever being a part of it. But if they bring them in, their own credibility will go down the drain. Right? So yeah. there yeah. is a dilemma that the center-right is facing right now. Right? That's why they don't know exactly what to do. And there is a lot of internal debate going on. You can see it on the news, like different commentators, like how we deal with this. And today, André Ventura, the leader of Chega, said that very clearly, like actually last night and today is being repeated, that he will not give support to any government of the center right if he is not taken into government.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a dilemma that right wing, you know, or establishment right wing parties, traditional right wing parties have faced when confronted with a kind of right wing upstart, you know, someone to the right and also a more the more populist sort of message and sell. What I find interesting, and also kind of within the same context, is that often when these parties come to power, obviously Chega only achieved 18%. So we're not doing this isn't an episode about, wow, right-wing populist enters into government shock kind of episode. We did that with Argentina a couple of months back. And there are some similarities that I want to draw upon, which is that a lot of the time when these governments come into power, these parties are able to form a government, they don't actually change that much. So they'll often be pulled towards a lot of the culture wars issues because it's soft stuff, which you can achieve something quite easily. Even you can achieve something ideologically and rhetorically without having to really, pass policies, pass things through Congress or through Parliament. You're not actually needing to do anything really programmatic. What ends up being, I think, in some ways, the most damaging aspect of these parties is the way that at least some of them reconfigure the past and kind of relitigate things which would many thought was now a consensus, right? So democracy, not being a dictatorship as a basic fundamental thing. And you have it with Fratelli d'Italia in mm-hmm. Italy, where they're some of the most kind of troubling aspects is the way that they have tried to somehow re-enamor reinvigorate the image of Mussolini and fascism. You had the same thing with Bolsonaro in Brazil, with nostalgia for the military dictatorship. And you have it to a certain extent in Argentina, even not so much with Milei himself directly, but with his vice president, who certainly is a nostalgic for the military dictatorship. And so I think in many ways, one of the major contributions of a lot of the right populists is to relitigate the past and to kind of start a discussion, I guess, about who we are as a country. And a lot of, so with the stuff that I asked you at the beginning about how Portugal sees itself, I thought it was interesting that the legacy of the Carnation Revolution is a very important part, I think, in terms of contemporary Portuguese identity. So I wondered if there's something similar going on with Chega or not at all. I mean, is there any kind of nostalgia for dictatorship expressed amongst, Chega politicians, for example?
Let me say this. We have an actual fascist party. You know, the ones who have that line, the ones who say Salazar, which was, you know, the Portuguese, you know, but just for people who might not, was the longstanding Portuguese dictator. Salazar was, you know, the best figure in Portuguese politics. The 25th of April was the beginning of the disaster and all of that. And so we do have an actual fascist party. They represent, I mean, I can give you the numbers. They represent, oh, no, I didn't open it, but like 0.0. Yeah, okay. I mean the numbers, the voting numbers. they represent like 0.01% something like that, right? So the smartness of Chega is how it is able to sort of point to some things in the past without ever naming them. Because if you would actually say something like this in Portugal, it wouldn't work. Like, you can't call, like, there was this whole thing during their last convention where someone went on stage and said he was a fascist. And the leader of the party himself had to come and say, no, you know, like, we are not fascists. We are Democrats. We are, you know, all of that. So you can't, like, that is their art, is how they point to the past without actually ever fully naming it. One thing that they introduced in this campaign, which is quite new for us, is the idea that we've been living under socialism for 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. Or almost 50 years, because they don't want to really equate the right-wing governments, the center-right governments into this. And so this idea that socialism is bad, and socialism was what brought us here, you know, and that we've been living under socialism for all this time, that is sort of pointing to the past without naming it. So I think this is, they don't fully say this, and they don't point to the dictatorship as something good. Not even the, you know, we did have some years during the dictatorship where we had economic growth, but they don't talk about that, you know. Because for most of the 50 years, Portugal was a highly impoverished country, although there were some years where there was economic growth.
It would also probably set up an expectation that they themselves would be able to bring in economic growth, which is a tough, you know, you're setting yourself up for something. Yeah,
exactly. They don't, because they don't even have an actual program for it. Like, their program is both fully like neoliberal. At the same time, they say they want to tax the richest, like the banks. They want to lower the tax for everyone else. You know, it's like it's a completely mayonnaise of a program that is done to, like, it's sort of a catch-all kind of right-wing party. We know what it is, but the way they try to present themselves is almost like an ideological party. You know, just so anti-corruption, we will. So their big slogan for this election was we will clean up Portugal. That's it. That was the election. That was the slogan. You know,
right. And I guess that works if you're kind of anti-corruption, anti-political establishment. If you're anti-migration and have more kind of right-wing hygienist politics, maybe you read it that way.
You read it that way. Yeah. If you want to clean the country from socialism, you read it that way. Right. From cultural Marxism, you read it that way. From gender ideology, you read it that way. You see, so it's kind of, it's out of a catch-all phrase So in a way, a catch-all party. And if you think that cleaning up the cleaning up Portugal means cleaning the remains of, you know, the labor laws that we have, then you read it that way. You see, so it works in that sense. Mm-hmm. And I think they're very smart on their message. Actually, this is just a little anecdote, but it does, I feel, is an important thing. André Ventura, the leader of the party, has the second most followed TikTok account in Portugal. They make videos every day, you know, like it's the second most followed TikTok account of Portuguese TikTok account, of course. The second.
Yeah, well, that's big. That's and as you say, kind of tapped into some youth vote there. I wanted to return just a little bit to the question of immigration, just briefly. Yes. Portugal, I think a lot of people know, more traditionally a country of emigration, not of immigration. Loads of Portuguese from the 1970s moved to France, for example, I think in large number to Switzerland and so on. And I think it's kind of an interesting thing when you're looking at countries which have been suffering from emigration, even population decline. I don't know if that's so much the case in Portugal, but those anxieties sometimes manifest themselves precisely as kind of concern about immigration, rather than necessarily expressing it themselves about what they actually are, which is emigration of all the kind of young, kind of talented, ambitious people moving to France or England or somewhere at the kind of top higher end of the food chain. Not that, you know, Portugal doesn't have its immigrants as well, as we were saying, a lot from Brazil. It hit the news here, just to mention this, hit the news here in Brazil that there were Brazilians involved in Chega's anti-immigration kind of demonstrations. And there was a lot of Brazilians going, what the hell is that about? But of course, often there may be white Brazilians who kind of, for them, it's a kind of racially coded thing against black immigrants, whether they're from Brazil or from Lusophone Africa. I wanted to know kind of how this anti-immigration politics has played out in a country which I think hasn't had those sorts of politics until fairly recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, the immigration question was very present in the campaign because we, during the Troika years, actually we had a migration wave that was bigger than the 60s. So more than 500,000 people left the country, wow, most of them young and with higher education. Some of them, I am one of those people. I was a crisis migrant, and a lot of us returned, or a lot of people did return after a while. Not all, of course. But I think the last years, Portugal lost like 20,000 nurses, for example. You know, so there is still a lot of like higher education migration from Portuguese youth that is going specifically to Europe, they were going to the UK. Now it's gotten a bit harder, but to Germany, even to Spain, to work, of course, for better paid jobs than here, but not so well paid jobs there. That is the typical thing. So the emigration question during this campaign was very present, as in everyone was saying, we want our youth to be able to stay. Of course, because we are having a new emigration wave because of the housing crisis, because people cannot afford to live in Portugal. It's becoming impossible. So we are having right now, we're experiencing right now a new emigration wave. At the same time, we have a new immigration wave, right? So we have a lot of Brazilians. The first part of this, I would say, started with Bolsonaro. The first waves started at the beginning of the Bolsonaro years. And they play very different roles in Portuguese politics. On the one hand, you have like the high to middle class white Brazilians who are right wing or conservative and who support Chega, but at the same time you do have a lot of left wing younger Brazilians that came to Portugal and that actually are helping revitalize the Portuguese social movement, which has been very important here. So it's very good and very interesting to see that the whole movement around the housing crisis has a lot of Brazilian voices, for example. And that is very interesting and very good. And they have contributed also in a very positive way to the debate on immigration and also on racism and on the Portuguese history of colonialism, which was something that was not discussed in this country. So that has brought about, so the wave of Brazilian migration also opened new questions. But then we have also a new migration, which is not, I mean, which has been happening, but now it's just more massive. And it's mainly to the south, not only, but what I was telling you about, so farm wage laborers, which are Pakistani, Bangladeshi. And this is not only about racialization. I'm sure that also happens. It's about very low skilled, low paid, a lot of them clandestine migrants. And we do have, you know, in terms of, if you bring up the question of racialization, we do have migration from the former Portuguese colony, so from the Lusophone world. But that has been quite a, you know, a steady stream over the years. There's not a, you know, an upsurge in like Cape Verdean migrants, for example. That's not what is happening. The new groups that we're seeing today, especially to do the very low paid agricultural work, are Bangladeshi, Pakistani migrants that mostly come, some Northern Africans that mostly come through, you know, mafia structures and clandestine and live 20 people in one apartment and so on and so forth. So that is the reality. That's the reality that Chega tackled on, especially in the south,
right?
Because that's where they're present much more than, you know, in urban areas. You don't, that is not the reality in urban areas as much, right?
Right. So that's all very interesting. And I think it leads us nicely into the question of the housing crisis, because this is obviously a kind of a global story where it's across the West. You listener, where you're watching this or listening to this, you're probably also thinking about housing crisis where you are, about the rent being too damn high and so on. So I wanted to know what the Portuguese situation has been. I mean, Portugal, I know Lisbon in particular, was until recently talked about as a kind of destination, not just for tourism, which I think has been, which has massively increased, but also for, you know, what's it called? I've completely forgotten the name of what that, what
digital
it's called.
Nomads?
Digital nomads. That's what I was going to, that's what I was looking for. Thank you. Tech startups and all that kind of thing. And of course, this is all contributed to this housing crisis. So how severe is it?
It's very severe. It's like, so let me, one thing that is important to say also about Portugal, like since we're making sort of also a little bit of a portrait of the country, Portugal has only 2% of public housing in its all, in its whole housing map.
Stock,
right?
Yeah, housing stock.
Housing,
yeah.
Stock, exactly. That's how you say it in English. The whole housing stock, only 2% is public. So it is quite complicated to have public policies that, you know, indirectly intervene in the market, you know, by, you know, just low, okay, we lower our prices, we put a rent cap and public housing, and therefore the market will respond. That is not possible to do in Portugal because it's 2% and most of it is social housing. So that is not, so there is actually a clear difficulty to just indirectly intervene in the market. So the only possibility to do it is to directly intervene in the market, meaning there are like, the number will be like around 750,000 empty houses in the country. You know, the state has to expropriate them, make them public, renovate them, put them, you know, turn them into public housing, for example. The idea of the Socialist Party for this campaign, which was just to like give some sort of credit benefit for younger people who buy houses, does not solve the problem. First, because it's just a benefit for the banks. I mean, it's a benefit, but it's just, you're not changing the actual dynamic. You're not actually building an instrument that is capable of intervening in the house market. But what happened in Portugal were several things. First, it was the turn into tourism as the most important economic specialization, right? So everything became a hotel, an Airbnb, a local rental, whatever, you know. So, so there's massive construction all over the country. It's not only in the big cities anymore. And of course, that makes, on the one hand, housing less available. And on the other hand, of course, it rises the prices. The second thing that happened, which was something that was introduced during the Troika, was what was called the golden visas. Meant, I don't know if you have this anywhere else, if you would buy a property of at least €500,000, you would immediately get Portuguese citizenship. This is not very interesting for the Portuguese citizenship itself. It's interesting for the European citizenship. So we had a massive wave of Chinese and Russian home buyers of buying like luxury housing to get immediate access to the European market. That's what it meant, right? And that, of course, has turned also the construction of new housing into the luxury sector. So there is a lot of construction happening, but it's not construction for housing for normal people. It's construction. It's for the luxury fringe. It's happening everywhere. And the digital nomad policies means that if you decide to come and live in Portugal, you pay actually like 20% less taxes. So you're not only, you don't only have a much higher wage, a much more affordable housing situation for you, and a much more affordable lifestyle, you actually have to pay less taxes than any regular Portuguese worker. So we're talking that we're speaking about the situation in a country where the minimum wage is €820 a month, and the median wage, which is, by the way, falling right now, is around 1500.
Wow.
Just like a month ago, there was a study done. The median wage is actually falling because more and more people are working in the tourist sector, in the tourism sector, working for a minimum wage. And so the mass of people that are hired gaining the minimum wage is already pushing down the median wage. And so imagine if you have a minimum wage, or even, okay, let's say you earn more than the minimum wage. You earn 100, you take home 1,000 euros a month. In Lisbon and in Porto, you cannot find an apartment for less than 800 for with one room.
Yeah, that's very expensive.
So
yeah.
You can't. It's impossible. So people are, of course, there's a huge dynamic of gentrification. Of course, that was already happening slowly. Now it's, but the problem is that because this is happening all over the country, people cannot find places to live anywhere. So the commutes are impossible. People cannot make it to work. So that's why we are having actually a new immigration momentum right now. So this is a housing crisis, and it cannot be resolved without direct state intervention. It is not possible. That because we can't indirect control the market because we don't have enough housing for it right now.
Right. And I mean, does this play out politically in any distinct way? You know, from what you've told me, it doesn't seem like it has explicitly, maybe in sort of indirect ways, maybe support for Chega's anti-immigration politics, but nothing kind of directed at housing, which incidentally, I mean, just as an aside, given how fundamental this political economic problem is in so many different countries in so many different cities around the world, it's amazing how little politics there has been around this issue. Because, you know, even just as a single issue party, one would think that there would be kind of a little more political activity springing up around this. So I find that interesting. I don't know if you've found anything trying to combat this in Portugal.
So we have the housing crisis was one of the most important topics of the campaign. I would say the most important topics of the campaign were the national health system, public schools, and the housing crisis. I would think these were the three main topics. So the housing crisis is sort of in the middle of all the political debates. We have a party that has you know, they didn't grow very much, but they did assert themselves more this elections, which is the first, you know, liberal party, economically liberal party, as they call themselves, Iniciativa Liberal, Liberal Initiative. And of course, there was, you know, the debate was about the market resolves or the state resolves, right? So that debate was happening right now. And we had the left saying the state needs to resolve. We had the center left saying the state needs to resolve through the banks. So we need, you know, sort of this added credit system, bona fide credit. The center right saying the state might, you know, have to do a couple of things, but mainly the market resolves. And then you had the right, where you include the Liberal Initiative and Chega, saying no, the market resolves. However, Chega has a twist to this, which is saying we also have a housing problem because of the migrants. They are filling our cities. So their answer to the housing crisis is we need migration control, very strict, tight migration controls. Because the problem with the housing in Portugal is that there's not enough housing and the migrants are taking them all, which is completely false. But that was what they built on. And that is, again, why it worked very much in the south, where people feel the presence of new migrants in a way that you don't feel it in other places.
Right. Yeah. I think this has been an amazing kind of portrait of all the different things that are going on in the country. Two final things, I think. One about kind of identity, about national identity. And just before that, perhaps related, about Europeanization. So I don't know if the European question has been raised in Portuguese politics recently. It's really 10 years now since the depths of the Euro crisis. Kind of amazing that so much time has passed. So kind of maybe reflecting back on that, I wonder if there has been kind of the European question raised at all. I think I did pick out one bit that you said earlier about how turnout has tended to fall at every stage of deeper European integration, which I think is perfect. I mean, that encapsulates it very well. So any thoughts on this?
This is my, this is one of my dear questions, right? I think what happened in 2014, 2015, and the opening with all the anti-austerity, at least Euro-critical, if not EU-critical, but at least Euro-critical left-wing parties in Europe, the fact that this moment is clearly over, really closed the space for this debate, which is really problematic. The Communist Party, the Communist Party is the only party in Portugal who has had a very steady Euro-critical, EU-critical position. And I do believe, and I think I've told you this in 2019 when we talked about European elections, they were clearly punished for it in the elections, and they're going to be punished again for it this time, because there is no space open for this. What is interesting is that, you know, for example, Meloni, she during her campaign, you know, you could see some of the Euro-critical vibe in it, you know, as a lot of the populist far right tends to express during campaign. But then actually, that is not true, you know. What is interesting about Chega is that they didn't even go there. They didn't even open. And it is very interesting that during the debates, so there were debates between all the party leaders, two on two. In the debate with both Bloco and the Communist Party, André Ventura, the leader of Chega, tried to smash the parties for them being Eurocritical.
Wow, right.
You know, and irresponsible, you see? So that is a very interesting characteristic that has to do with being the periphery of the periphery, which is like, you don't, not even the far right touches the question of European integration, because that is too much of, you know, a difficult question. You don't want to touch it because it is really too unpopular. People are already too scared. And, you know, the whole thing about at least all the European funds now are coming and they're going to save us, if you open the question about European criticism, you're going to be punished for it. Of course, what we know, which is the reality, is that after austerity, the levels of public investment, where public investment was put into, the levels of public debt, I mean, they're basically, you know, they are completely dictated by European rules. And of course, there's a lot of, you know, in terms of, you mentioned in the beginning about Pedro Nuno Santos, the leader of the Socialist Party, the new leader, who has been for many years sort of the representation of the left-wing fraction within the Socialist Party. He himself knows that if he actually wants to seriously talk about industrial policy, he has to go against Brussels. And he was the Minister of Infrastructure, which was interesting. So he was dealing with it. He got the poisoned ministry because it's the one that is very hard to deal, especially if you are bound to the strict rules of the European budgetary treaty, for example, right? So it's a golden cage. It's very hard to get rid of. But the interesting thing is that it did not come up in these elections from no one. It's too much of a damaging topic, so much so that the far right responds this way. So I'm actually very curious, since we're going to have elections in May this year, European elections, sorry, in May this year, how the far right is going to navigate this question in particular. Because they can't just have the same discourse as the center right, right, concerning the European Union. But in Portugal, to be Eurocritical right now, that moment shut down, so it's very tainted. And I think it will also be very interesting how the left will position in this. And I think the Communist Party will follow the line that they've followed, and unfortunately will be punished for it again. So it is really a very tough one.
No, that's fascinating. Maybe we should catch up after the
sure,
and see how that actually went. But I find that both fascinating and kind of tragic and disappointing.
Yeah,
to hear how maybe there was a window, it was discussed as a question, you know, last decade, and now that's disappeared from political discourse entirely. Right. So one final question. As I mentioned earlier on, Portugal is going to celebrate 50 years since the Carnation Revolution next month. That was the beginning of the last great wave of regime change around the world, I think, right? That was
right.
Kind of one of the chapters, an important chapter in the kind of redemocratization or democratization around the world, which kind of ran for a good 15, 20 years from the mid-70s until into the early 90s. And now I guess it'll be a moment to look back on that experience. I imagine it'll be celebrated in Portugal. It'll be marked as a historic moment. How is it going to be commemorated? Do you know?
So it is already being commemorated since last year. It started last year. There are every trade union, small local association, cultural collective, parties, everyone has their own programs and agendas. I think if you would look at an agenda like every day until April and even further on, you have something somewhere in the country, more than one thing commemorating and rethinking the Carnation Revolution. So on the 25th of April, there on the night, the 24th to the 25th, there will be a big concentration in a lot of cities, as it there normally is. I expect this year it will be bigger than usual. And on the 25th of April, there's always a demonstration that I also expect, given this result, that it will hopefully be massive. I think people understand that you need to come out this time. Just one little thing that I think is interesting about how that you mentioned about past, and now there's also a struggle for the past going on here. The Liberal Initiative, this right-wing Liberal Party, they have a sort of a think tank called Mais Liberdade, More Freedom, who has like almost €1 million as an annual budget, given mainly a big part of it by two millionaires. And they are running Portuguese public schools with an exhibition on the 25th of November. The 25th of November, 75, was the day that the revolution ended. So there has been always a struggle between the left and the right about what actually brought democratization, if it was the revolutionary process, or if it was the end of the revolutionary process that mm-hmm. translated then later into a normal, you know, established bourgeois parliamentary democracy. And I think it's very interesting that at almost 300 schools across the country have asked for this exhibition. And I'm guessing some of them is, you know, they just, you know, think it's just some cool thing they can have in their schools. But a lot of them is probably out of militancy. So there is a debate on the past, and there is a debate on the roots of Portuguese democracy that is going on right now, and where the side of the actual democratic process that started in the 24th to the 25th of April 74 needs to regain strength, because there is really a clash on the interpretation of both the revolution and on the sense of democracy itself going on in the country.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how that develops. Thank you so much for this panorama of Portugal. I don't think we've ever done Portugal in a dedicated fashion on this podcast. And as a consequence, I've had to come like with all these questions.
That's good.
But you've answered them all. So it's been excellent. Thank you, Catarina, and happy birthday.
Of course, again. Alex. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon, yeah?
Cheers.